meeting, Saturday, 19th November, 1988.
Last month, we have been talking about the body. The body's importance is hardly rightly appreciated by most people. And those who are concerned with a religious life have the misfortune to have the body depreciated by a good deal of so-called religious teaching. Now, this is a complete absurdity. Note carefully that a person is essentially known by his body. You give a name to that body, and that body is recognized as that person. The body has been called, and quite rightly called, a microcosm. That means a little cosmos. Just as the total universe is the macrocosm, the body is the microcosm. And the body is the concrete expression of all the energies at play. The transcendent energies, spiritual energies, psychical energies, and physical energies. And by physical energies I mean the ordinary energies that we know of: electricity, magnetism, heat, chemical energy, and so on. So you see, the body is really something extraordinarily important. It is the representative on the small scale of what we see and learn about on the large scale as the universe, the macrocosm. Now, unless there was the body, there would be no such thing as the spirit or the soul. The spirit is the subtlest expression of the creative energy, whatever that creative energy may be. And matter is the concretest expression of it. But as such, matter is spirit, and spirit and matter are both the creative energy as such. Our task as human beings is so to live that we, whilst we are alive, if possible, realize this truth, that we as individuals are the transcendent energy itself, concretized, expressed. And our business is to show, to live that that energy comes to fruition in terms which we call human. That is essentially in terms of the great spiritual values: wisdom, love, truth, beauty, goodness, purity, you name them just as you will. So to despise the body is a profound mistake. If one despises or hates oneself, then it is very easy to despise and hate all other people. So we see the importance of bodily training where yoga is concerned. the asanas, the yogic asanas and the pranayama have one outstanding purpose. So to train the organism that the organism offers no hindrance to becoming conscious of the transcendent reality and the expression of that transcendent reality in the in human terms in throughout our life. Now, last month I read a good bit in that connection and we discussed it. Now, while the main purpose of the yogic discipline of postures and breathing is to be free of interference by the body during meditation, there is a much deeper purpose associated with the deeper meanings of the words asana and pranayama. It is that the body shall be a fit instrument for the reception and transmission of the energies of transcendent associated with the states of holistic consciousness realized in the different intensities of communion. We talk of communion as samadhi, that is the Sanskrit and Pali word. It's the state of communion, the state of supreme togetherness, at one moment with and in the totality. For this, the finest discipline is required. And here it is necessary to understand that discipline means learning by growing happily and healthily. Gruesome austerity or self-inflicted pain is masochism, a perverted form of self-indulgence through experiencing intense sensations, a manifestation of a sick soul, a means for winning the worthless respect and adulation of a stupid multitude. Right austerity, a complete contrast to the gruesome austerity of the misguided of East and West alike through the centuries, means abstention from self-indulgence, from violence, from ego assertion, masquerading all too often as self-expression, and any and every form of evil. Right austerity is not an incontinent continence, a consequence of a hate reaction against past misery or of a lust for superiority over others. Right austerity is present when I see the truth for myself and act spontaneously in accord with the vision, and not out of mere conformity with the imposed word of which I have not clearly understood the spirit. An ignorant, foolish man slavishly doing the right thing in the absence of clear perception not only remains ignorant and foolish, but also suffers from the conceit that he is good, doing the right thing. Right austerity demands ceaseless attentiveness on my part, clear seeing and right doing, which are the mental and physical aspects of learning by growing, and the constant natural discarding of unessentials. Unessential because I have outgrown them. The Buddha declares, the person who is neither a self-tormentor, not intent on the practice of self-torment, nor a tormentor of others, not intent on the practice of tormenting others. He, neither a self-tormentor nor a tormentor of others, is here now allayed, quenched, become cool, an experiencer of bliss that lives with self, Brahman become. This is a weighty declaration. A careful study of the whole discourse would amply repay the serious student. The discourse comes in the Majjhima Nikaya, the pages of the Pali version being 338, 48 and 349. Now, let us consider these points. No considerations? There are two aspects specifically involved in this. One is compelling the body with the idea that one is progressing spiritually, and the other is indulging the body. That means, of course, that includes all sense indulgence. The right use of the senses is very different from sense indulgence. Somebody likes playing tennis or swimming. Somebody likes drinking alcoholic liquors and so forth. and he indulges himself. If somebody has a specific gift as a poet, a musician, or whatever it may be, then he can educate, cultivate that gift and help both himself and his environment with it. Or somebody likes to read because he is intellectually greedy. He wants to know all about everything. That is an indulgence. Is it or is it not?
Is perhaps the key to this encapsulated in the phrase that the thought is master of the deed, because surely the deed shall follow on from however you are thinking.
The deed follows from the thought, yes. But how does the thought arise? What precedes the thought? Surely a sense observation or a natural desire from within. And then one thinks, one calculates, plans out how he shall fulfill that, doesn't it?
That's really what I meant, that sometimes will be a long process because it's very difficult sometimes. But if the thought is there, then you must perforce eventually achieve.
Yes?
Are we not in our considerations endeavouring to understand the relationship between a body? Accent is very much on body, is it not? And the rest of us, which in my own humble experience brings us slap up against the I. Who am I? What am I? In relation to body, mind, and the rest of the human person. As one gets older, at least it's been my experience, and I'm sure others have had it, I sometimes say to myself, why on earth am I going to all this trouble? Doing all the right things, eating all the right foods, studying all the right books. If at the end of this, I'm just a lot of ashes, which may or may not be returned to the earth from whence I came.
So what you're saying leads to the importance and the necessity for self-knowing. This word I, this represents the particular psychophysical organism when it refers to itself. And it uses the word I, and with reference to anybody and everybody else, it uses the word you. And self-knowing, of course, is of fundamental importance where the human life is concerned. we are too fond of talking in terms of the spiritual life or the artistic life or this life or that life. It is all part and parcel of the activity of a human being, the human life. And what is the meaning of the word human? What would you say is the meaning of the word human?
Happy creator,
I think, is what you...
Yes, that's what I have been saying. Blissful creator. And how can you be a blissful creator? That is the question. What is it that prevents me from being a blissful creator?
Because of your fallibility.
Huh?
Because you're fallible. You're mortal. You're mortal.
No, I was asking, what is it that prevents me from being a blissful creator?
Is it separativeness, Rose? Separativeness.
Yes, separativeness is one of the elements. That is the mode in which most people are normally aware of themselves in relation to their whole environment, which includes all people.
Well, the fundamental thing that would prevent me, as I see it, from being a happy creator as such would be my selfishness.
Selfishness?
Self-centeredness.
Self-centeredness, perhaps.
Self-centeredness.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, that is a very important point.
And fear, which I suppose is self-centeredness.
Fear is another, yes. You said fear?
Mm.
Yes.
Self-centeredness comes back to self-indulgence, I guess.
Yes, yes. How does self-centeredness operate? What sort of technique has it got?
Because I suppose it sees everything, or most things, in relation to oneself.
Yeah.
That's how it would operate, I think.
And then take sides for
one side.
And then take sides.
Yes.
Yes.
And then take sides, yes. But most people live intensely conscious of themselves as just themselves, separate from the not self, which is the rest of the universe. You see? And they try to draw out of the not self everything that they want for themselves, everything that they wish. So there is no reciprocity, no give and take about it. I want, I wish, I like, I must have. And this is something which grows right from infancy onwards. Starts with food, mostly, which is, of course, reminiscent of the fact that we are an animal species. Animals are like that.
But it's necessary for survival, Firoz, the basic animal instinct.
Yes.
Which goes back to not discarding any bodily function.
Yes, it's necessary for survival. But there comes the point when the desire for food, we'll say, is an unhealthy desire. Wants more and more and more. I like it, therefore I'm going to have more of it. Take the drunkard, for instance, and see what happens to him.
Firoz, don't you think it starts at a very early age when the child is able to be taught that if it is a good little girl or a good little boy,
it's going to get a sweetie. But if it's naughty, it won't. Today's children demand a lot more than just a sweetie. But I think in all fairness, we have to consider that we are handed on an awful lot of do's and don'ts. At least I was, I think our generation were, which is already breeding in us a desire to please, because mummy and daddy will be pleased about that. So the foundation of the duality is laid rather early in our lives, is it not?
Yes, that is so. And because of that duality, there is the constant conflict. This pleases me, but that pleases daddy or mommy. Which shall it be, me or the parent?
Yes, and I think we do also see ourselves, the separate thing, as encased in a body as well, which immediately makes us separate inside something which we are all sort of aware of, which is another form of self-centeredness. But I think really if I consider it, I see myself separate, especially because of this, the material side of me.
Yes, the body's a boundary.
Yes, which I definitely feel.
Yes, the separateness is so much easier to see than the non-separateness. Because after all, the body as body is composed of the same chemical elements as any other body, any other human body. Not only is it composed of the same elements, chemical elements, but it functions also in just the same way. Everybody's heart, liver, kidneys, and so on, they all function in just that particular way. So there is a non-difference between any one body and any other body. And the same applies to the psychical aspect. But we are not conscious of this. If we were truly conscious of it, we should be at one with anybody and everybody. It's difficult, because when somebody is a murderer or a rapist or a thief or something like that, and oneself is not a murderer, it's rather difficult to feel at one with the murderer. And yet, how often have we felt, especially in our young days, I wish so and so were dead. Look at youngsters playing with toy guns. Bang, bang, you're dead. Not that they wish the other person really dead, because they want to kill him again once he's up and alive. But there they are. The bulk of human beings remain foolish children throughout their lifetime. And that's the tragic part of the story.
Although there are fundamental samenesses in the body, in bodies, there are also great differences on the body, aren't there, on a different level. I mean, some people can do one thing and some people can't. Some people have deformities. I mean, there are enormous differences in the body.
Yes.
And some people are much better at things than others.
Those are faculties of the particular body. The difference lies in the different faculties.
And it is
look at a child who is gifted with, say, playing on a piano, like a grown-up. How is that? Well, I don't know.
I think there you've just said something that is tremendously important to bear in mind. There is so much that we don't know. And I think we have to start off by being absolutely honest about it. Because surely it is only our lives, if we're really wanting to know these things, that are going to give us some idea, some of the clues. And even then, is one always certain and sure? Whenever I've settled comfortably down in something, well, I've been very rudely awakened. And I think that young people of today, the generations of today, are particularly fortunate insofar as there is an enormous amount of real, genuine, honest investigation going on. Now, I'm forever saying that we live in this world of duality, so the pendulum swings right up this end and right down to the next end, but sooner or later, it gradually begins to find its own balance. And I think that's an enormous help in understanding ourselves, and in the understanding of ourselves, we begin to realize that we're not isolationists, we're not exclusive, whether they're physical problems or mental problems. We have enormous relationship, because we talk about the psyche, but, I mean, have we ever examined what is this psyche? Can I pick it up and say, oh, that's got my particular initial on it, it hasn't got yours? What is the psyche that we talk about? I've been personally very helped lately by reading this book of Amgard Schlegel called The Gentling of the Wool. And it's, some of you I'm sure will remember, because I had the Oxfording pictures here for quite some years on the steps here coming up to the study. And it's very clearly explained by Amgard what the function of this is. And it's all brought down to a very down-to-earth and acceptable simplicity, which of course is always very deceptive. But it's well worth reading. I think Ferrer's would agree.
Yes, better give the title again, because some people didn't quite hear. It's called Gentling the Bull, Making the Bull Gentle.
The bull being this psychic energy of ours, which gets so often out of control.
Ferrer's, In terms of enlightenment, do you feel, in terms of enlightenment, do you feel that it is given? For example, you've talked of the young child. who plays as well or if not better than an adult. Do you think that by the same token, there are some people to whom it is given? They are blessed in say for example, Krishnamurti was obviously very different from the word go.
Yes, it is so. Some are born that way.
Right. And so the evolutionary process seems to throw out just a couple of these people.
Throw out the extraordinary.
Yes.
In contrast to the ordinary.
Right.
Yes, that is so. Mm. Why and how that is so, I don't know. But there it is.
Under the greatest difficulties, remember all those terrible difficulties.
But that's what I'm saying, in spite of.
Yeah.
It happens for them.
In the learning process. Mm. Mm.
I'm not saying without a struggle, but...
Oh no, it's always in the things we dislike intensely that we learn the most. Otherwise we settle down comfortably in knowing this. Mm.
During the 1950s, I had a young boy, 5 years old, who could just extemporize perfectly. The harmony was all there, and so on. Of course, I mean, he couldn't play very brilliant things, but it was all musical. Mm. And he would himself be reduced to tears with the beauty of the sound. He was the son of a minister of religion who functioned with General Wingate's army in Burma. And there was this boy, and his elder brother was quite different from him. He was just an ordinary, healthy youngster, played games and all that stuff. But this boy could play on this very piano.
He was five
years of age. His mother brought him to me to learn to play the piano because she knew that I had learned from Solomon. But what was I to teach that little fellow? It was quite extraordinary.
What happened to him? Do you know?
Not the least idea. After the armies were disbanded and his father came back to England, he came and saw me and met me, and it was he who presented me with a book I treasure very much, that Concordance to the Bible. Is that the Concordance? That's the one. It's a most valuable book. He presented that to me.
If we go back to this business of gentling the psyche, can you hear? If we go back to this business of gentling the psyche, personally, I find it very difficult insofar as anybody's psyche is very influenced by the psyches of the rest of the world. Do you follow?
No.
It's.
I'm sorry.
You mean picking up on other people's.
Yes. But that's your challenge. And there's your relationship, is it not?
Yes, I agree.
I wouldn't for one moment, Liz, say that it was easy. It's extremely difficult.
See, my difficulty is I can't hear clearly.
Say it again.
I'm definitely getting deafer and deafer.
Liz is saying that she finds the gentling of the bull, of the psychic energy, extremely difficult, because she is so influenced by all the universal psyches are operating.
Of course. You see, Take, for instance, just the body. If you are in a polluted atmosphere, what can you do about it? Mm. It influences you to be unhealthy. A clean atmosphere, and you're all right. It's like that.
I think also the kind of life one has to lead, if you compare the life of a Trappist monk with somebody who has to enter into the hustle and bustle of the commercial world, then of course you are subjected to a vastly different range of
yes.
pressures.
Yes, that is so.
Exactly.
But surely, Liz, having seen it, haven't you solved it?
Why would I be sitting here?
No, just that one particular thing you mentioned.
No.
What else is there?
What else? Sorry, I don't follow you.
Well, you see, I think this conversation with Vises has been about conditioning, hasn't it? I think the original proposition, the question was, what stops us from being a blissful creator? And I was putting forward, perhaps, that in some cases it's just enough to see. And anything about seeing then becomes conditioning, or the reaction is perhaps from conditioning.
Yes, or perhaps we don't see in the right way in order to be able to let it go.
Well, it's obvious that it cannot be one single thing. Is that not so, John? I mean,
Lattering to Liz. I apologise for that. I didn't hear what you said.
No, I apologise. You brought out a very, I should imagine, valid point. That it's never one thing. It's a combination of so many things.
But perhaps if you realised that the environment that you found yourself in was not conducive to the religious life, if you saw it truly, you would remove yourself from it.